Maybe we start with interdependency. What is that exactly?
Well, interdependence is the situation where our fates, our rewards and punishments, our everything are all tied up together. And so we are naturally concerned with the fate of the others because our own fate is tied up with it. So we are dependent on one another for getting done what we want to get done. And this changes the logic of the relationship.
That's unusual because most people tend to think there is the selfish gene on the level of genes, mm-hmm. and there is selfish behavior on the level of behavior, and then, you know, very far away, other people come into place.
One of the main arguments in the book is that there is a sort of new form of rationality, if you will, that comes into being with a cooperative, interdependent way of life. And that is a kind of cooperative rationality, that it's things where the term rationality is quite often used for selfish, for mm-hmm. rational maximizing in economics and whatnot. Here I want to say that when you're in an interdependent situation where you're depending on others, mm-hmm. The rationality changes. And it's now important to support your interdependent partners. And it's important to make sure that they feel like they've been treated fairly and so forth.
There are two concepts of rationality, if I understand that correctly. One is simply meaning it serves a purpose.
Yes.
Very well.
Yes.
Instrumental rationality.
Yes.
That's not what you mean.
No, not at all. Not at all. the rationality in this is, makes sense for my life and my way of being, and ultimately my sense of self. So again, one of the arguments in the book is that most approaches to morality that come at it from an evolutionary point of view, the ultimate mechanism is reputation, is that I want to be mm-hmm. nice and fair and cooperative because all these other people are watching and I need them to believe that I'm cooperative. And so it's how they view me. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I argue here is that I am part of the community of people who judge. Also, I judge other people. Mm-hmm. And I am part of the body that is judging me mm-hmm. as I am judged. So, mm-hmm. And so I believe it's a legitimate judgment when I say, oh, I shouldn't have done that. I'm viewing it as if I were judging someone else and saying they shouldn't have mm-hmm. done that. And so I actually think the critique of myself when I feel guilty is a legitimate one. So it's not that I worry what they think. It's mm-hmm. I worry what we think. Mm-hmm. And the we is all the they plus me mm-hmm. Making the judgment. And therefore, I really identify with it. And so it's not an externalized instrumental rationality of trying to make everybody else treat me well just mm-hmm. strategically. But it's that I believe they have a legitimate criticism if I'm doing something wrong. I agree with it. And I believe that I really shouldn't have done that and I should correct myself.
Is that a variation of what you, I think, call Bert's perspective?
Yeah.
Which makes a difference between us and great apes?
Yes, the bird's eye perspective is that I view myself as just another person. Mm-hmm. Thomas Nagel made this view from nowhere
yeah.
kind of idea. So I kind of borrowed that from him a bit. And that this is the sort of cognitive, psychological basis of judgments of impartiality, where you're viewing yourself. Mm-hmm. A judgment of fairness, you are one of the participants in the fairness mm-hmm. judgment quite often, but you're not treated any differently than anybody else. You are treating yourself the same way you treat everyone else. You're equally deserving, but no more so, no less so.
This thinking that I see myself from a different perspective, the perspective of the other, is that an ability which monkeys also have?
I don't believe so. This is a very crucial point is, we have demonstrated in our studies with apes that they understand he sees the banana.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and we've done experiments that show that they can accommodate the situation where the other guy sees the banana and where he doesn't, and they can tell the difference. But I don't think, we have no evidence that they know. He knows that I see the banana.
Mm-hmm.
So they can't understand another person's perspective on my mental states.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they don't do that. And I think much of what is unique about humans gets down to that, because this notion of shared intentionality and having a shared goal with different roles and different perspectives, you have to be able to view yourself the way your partner views you in that kind of interaction.
Does that imply that before I act in a moral way as we understand it, I have to have at least some theory of mind or some theory about the minds of others?
Yes. The term theory of mind is a quite broad one. And if you take the really broad brush, I would say chimpanzees have a little bit of a theory of mind, because they understand when others see things or when others have goals toward things. And so they have a little bit of it. And so I would emphasize this point about how, with a recursive step, they are viewing me. So the humans have a theory about how other people are viewing them, not just that others have a theory of mind, but that they how they view my mental states and can embed mental states in one another in a way. And that when you get to that, you can actually have what is the basis of much of human morality, which is, and Thomas Nagel makes this point, how would you like it if someone treated you like that?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is the ultimate answer. When someone, I use the old Humean example, I step on your toe and you say, what are you doing? And I say, well, I just felt like stepping on your toe. And what can you say to me to convince me? And you have to say,
it's not a good behavior.
It's not a good behavior. You say, well, how would you like it if someone did that to you?
Right.
And for that reason to make sense, I have to be able to look at it from either side.
Are you saying that great apes have some sense of reciprocity?
No, I was trying to say that that seeing it from both sides was a human thing.
So that's unique to us.
That's unique to humans. I believe it is.
Mm-hmm. Do they have a sense of fairness?
No. And this is a disagreement that I have with Franz De Waal, for example.
Mm-hmm.
We have experiments now which speak to the issue. The De Waal fairness experiments that are on YouTube and are so convincing to everyone is that the monkey, he's done it with apes, but the monkey is the video tube, is given a cucumber, and then another monkey is given a grape.
Mm-hmm.
And the monkey who would normally have the cucumber, eat the cucumber happily, mm-hmm. if he sees the other one get the grape, he rejects it.
So that's being unhappy by comparison, so to speak.
That is his interpretation of the experiment.
Right.
But you have to have the proper control. And the proper control is, for example, there's no monkey there at all.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a grape sitting out in the open that the experimenter could give me.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't. So I reject the cucumber, not by comparing to what the other guy is getting, but just that you, the experimenter, are giving me the bad one when you could be giving me the good one. So the anger is just at the experimenter for not giving me the better one, which he could have given me. And when you run the right control group, you see that's what they're reacting to, not comparison to the other.
Could they be angry at an apparatus giving them?
You just designed an experiment that we are currently doing. We have an apparatus doing this, and they don't get mad at the apparatus, but they get mad at the human when the human intentionally doesn't give them the better food.
So it's not in the object that they value one more than the other.
No,
which
but,
they do, but they don't get angry about it.
No, they don't. But they don't get angry about it. But they get angry at the person for giving it to them. But it's not a fairness judgment.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that you're not treating me fairly. It's that you're not giving me what I want, which even little tiny babies can get upset about. You're not giving me what I want, and I'm angry at you for that. But I'm not making a social comparison to someone else, and I'm not saying you're not treating me fairly. I'm just saying you're not treating me like I want you to treat me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the whole division between truly moral behavior and other, is that in the non-moral case, it's that I don't want you to because I just don't want you to. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's just my opinion, it's my feeling. Whereas in the moral case, I immediately jump to something higher and say, you ought not to do it. There's a reason why you shouldn't do it. There's mm-hmm. a principle, there's a norm that you're not adhering to that's not my personal opinion. It's something larger than that.
You did experiments with small children, and you found that they were behaving altruistically. Mm-hmm. Why is that the case?
Our research seems to show that from a year and a half or so, children help others naturally. They do not need to be socialized, rewarded, encouraged, shown. So we have studies where they are equally helpful whether mom is watching or not. They're equally helpful if mom is encouraging them or not. If they get rewarded for helping, it doesn't, in fact, it makes it worse later, not better. If they get rewarded and the reward is taken away, they sort of quit helping. So the helping is an intrinsic motivation that doesn't seem to be influenced by the socialization.
Does intrinsically translate to biologically?
Yes. it means that we're evolved to be that way. And it means that what I think there is a special case, though, about infants, and this is a point that we're currently working on, is that infants below about age 2 or 3 in the traditional setting, the traditional mm-hmm. social setting, are still on mom all the time. They're still nursing. They're with mom all the time. And they don't need to worry about uncooperative people, cheaters, liars, or whatever, because their social interactions are all being filtered through mom. Mom mm-hmm. is controlling things. So the little ones are indiscriminately helpful. And what happens is when they get out on their own and they have to be a little bit more careful, now they're weighing their own selfish interests and their safety and all that with these other things. But these little 18-month-olds, they just go, you know, they mm-hmm. get objects and they just help people. So they are naturally helpful. And then as they get older, they start weighing lots of other considerations around and they get socialized into when one should be careful and when one should be helpful and all that sort of thing.
So how does that relate to the, you know, decades of the selfish gene, which was, yeah, the predominant way to think about this?
Is you have to distinguish between the biological level and the psychological level. Mm-hmm. In a Darwinian natural selection framework, the individual can't be doing something that is self-destructive. They just can't. That's the logic of the whole thing, the way the whole thing works. But now, when you translate to psychology, it might be that being altruistic is going to end up bringing me more benefits of being into the group or whatever like that. But my psychology is not taking into account these long-term benefits. Mm-hmm. My psychology is, I want to help this person. The old lady on the train is struggling to put her suitcase up, and I just help her with it, and I feel good about helping her with it. And I'm not thinking about long-term benefits. I'm not thinking about the people in the train looking and thinking I'm a good guy or anything. I just want
to
help
her. Isn't that strange? Because the whole system, the Darwinian system, seems to be geared towards reward, being fitter in the sense of having more profit out of this behavior. Mm. And now you're saying reward doesn't really count.
It doesn't count on the psychological level. If being indiscriminately altruistic ended up getting me killed or whatever, then it wouldn't have evolved. So there is that level. But I also think there's another important element to the story that so some people have referred to this as a kind of a mistake hypothesis, that we're mistakenly, I mistakenly believe I'm doing it out of my own goodness, but it's actually at the biological level being rewarded. But that's, I think, mixing up the biological and the psychological levels.
Yeah.
And there's another part of it, which is that, and this is key to my account, that when you are evolved to be a cooperative individual with partners and with a group, you, for example, forage together with a partner, and you find some resource, you naturally want to divide it
equally.
And the reason is because this cooperative partnership, this interdependent partnership, I understand that you are equally a causal force for our success as I am. We're both equal partners. In addition, I understand that you could play my role and I could play your role. And the roles, these are instrumental roles now, that to catch an antelope, you have to do X, one role has to do X, and one role has to do Y. It doesn't matter who's in the role. So these criteria, these instrumental standards for each role are independent of the individual. So for these two reasons, that we're equal causal forces in producing it, and our roles could be switched and the criteria would stay the same, leads us to an understanding of others, other collaborative partners, as equally deserving as ourselves. And especially when you add in that free riders, people who aren't helping to contribute to the benefit, are kept out. So we are equally deserving, and the ones who didn't contribute are not, I would say is not a preference. It's a fact. It's just a fact that, so I wish it were the case that I was more important than everyone else in the world and that I deserved everything in the world more than everyone else. But I can't make myself believe it. Even though I wish it was the case, I can't make myself believe it because I know that you're just as real a person as I am and that you have beliefs and desires like I do and you're equally deserving as I am.
Does that imply that I have to have a clear concept of what the whole complex game with the various roles in it is?
That's the bird's eye view. The bird's eye view is that the way I first started talking about the bird's eye view was in this collaboration where I see your role and my role from up here so that we can switch roles because I understand the whole collaborative structure. And that's and that allows us to have impartial role standards by which each role is defined, regardless of whether I'm playing it or you're playing it.
When we are geared towards that sort of cooperation and we are basically moral beings, why is it that, at least at the moment, we are so bad in looking at the whole complex game of the planet, which is the game we play all together, you know, whether we come from different cultures or not? Why are we obviously doing so badly right now?
I would say that there's several long answers to that, but one of the main things is that I think all the people on the planet do not have a clear sense that we have a joint goal. Now, a lot of us believe that stopping climate change and you know, doing all of that thing is an important goal for all of humanity, but there are lots of people, and maybe the majority of people on the planet, who don't really engage with that as a joint goal. They don't. It's not a clear and present danger. They're saying, well, okay, the scientists say it's coming, but, you know, feels the same to me. Or, okay, they say that the hydrocarbons are, you know, polluting, you know, but air smells good to me. So it's not, it has not grabbed people in the way that a lot of us think it should.
But it's sort of in our genes to come to that point because it depends on our understanding what kind of game we play.
Yes, but I think there are a lot of people, certainly in my home country of America, who do not believe that it's a matter of life and death for the species that we stop climate change. That's one example, but they don't buy into the goal.
Right. From your point of view, what do you think would increase altruistic behavior in that sense?
Well, I've joked before, but say an invasion from outer space, okay? An invasion of alien beings from outer space, we'd all come together. We would. We would all come together. I had an experience with a colleague at my former university where we argued all the time about this altruism versus selfishness in an evolutionary context. And we're both arguing evolutionarily, and I'm arguing that when you're cooperative, the changes and all that. And we got in a seminar together with some humanists who didn't believe in evolution. And all of a sudden, we're on the same team. We're arguing against the evolutionists, and we're supporting one another's arguments, and all of a sudden... So this is the thing, that all of us who are have all that, we would have a common enemy. In my home country of the United States, when the 9/11 terrorist attack hit, that's the most coming together and the most patriotic I've ever seen the country. People who normally are, kind of blasé are putting a flag in their front yard, for God's sake. You know, what is that all about? So you have to come together against a common. They have to have a common goal, and a common enemy would be a good.
Okay.
Politicians exploit that all the time.
Yeah, politicians, it's the in-group, out-group thing.
Politicians exploit. They are coming after us. I mean, Putin is the best at it. Putin has convinced all of the Russian people that they're out to get us. The West wants us to fail, et cetera, et cetera. And the Russian people are quite united about that.
You're saying in your book that apes have sympathy towards each other. They don't have fairness, but they have sympathy. Mm-hmm. Now, colleagues of yours are at the moment experimenting with compassion, which is not exactly the concept you use. Is there a line, that leads from sympathy to compassion?
I'm not sure what compassion, exactly how it would be defined. What exactly do you mean by compassion?
Well, compassion would mean that I see every other being as part of the complex game we all play together. So in a very deep way, it's basically what you were saying too. In a very profound way, we are not two. We are one group.
We're in this together.
In this together, right. We are somehow we, which might even imply like monkeys or higher animals. Of course, there's a lot of debate about that, sure.
Yeah, but... Yeah, I'm not sure. I would say, I think ultimately, and I say this on page one of the book, ultimately, sympathy, compassion is evolutionarily going to come from parents caring for children. Where when people say, there are lots of people who want to deny altruistic or helping behavior in other animals. So there are studies with rats showing that rats help other rats. Are you kidding me? Rats can't be, right? But... All mammal parents sacrifice for their kids.
Right.
And this is oxytocin, whatever. This is the mom who is ready to jump in front of the predator for the sake of the child. We humans have that. I have a young daughter at home, and I would say, if a car is coming, I would jump and push her out of the way and get under the car. I mean, it's all the mammals have this as a parental response, or certainly a maternal response, because the mother, especially the maternal, different species have different, fathers are involved differently in different species, but in a maternal thing. And so the only issue is, can this get generalized in some way to non-offspring, to other individuals? Mm-hmm. And so one of the evolutionary hypotheses we have is that this kind of altruism, sympathy, compassion... for non-relatives, it would be very hard for that to evolve de novo. But you have the machinery already there, the hormones already there for caring for offspring. And now you only have to transfer them to a different target. And and so that's why I start out on page one of the book saying the basis of it all is... your willingness to sacrifice and help your offspring, and then interesting stuff happens to make that apply to non-relatives.
I know that is a bit that this is a bit philosophical, but doesn't it imply that my view of myself is different from the usual view we have? Because myself is not an isolated substance, but it's interdependent, which means it's as much the other as the other is me. Because we're constantly dependent on each other. Yes. And I can't really think of myself conceptually without thinking of the other or a we.
Absolutely. And our sense of self is all bound up with this. All you have to do is look in the contemporary world. Most of the really virulent conflicts are between groups that view themselves as us versus them, mm-hmm. but the us is an identity, that I am X. I am of this group, I am of this identity, we do things this way, they are heathens, they are barbarians, they don't, and they do it a different way. And most of the, virtually all of the of these huge conflicts in the world are a we versus they kind of conflict. And so they are viewing themselves in their group as mm-hmm. integrated with and identified with the others, and not with the out-group. And a really good piece of evidence is what is sometimes called collective guilt or collective mm-hmm. pride. Mm-hmm. So I am proud that my team, that the German soccer team in 2000, right. whatever it was, 2012, or whatever, won the World Cup, even though I myself didn't do a thing, right? And I grew up in the American South, and yeah. I feel somehow guilty about the way the American South treated African Americans when I was growing up. I myself didn't do anything bad, but I feel guilty. And the Germans, of course, have their version of collective guilt, even though the individual didn't do anything themselves.
What happened there? Because we have that in our evolution, that we started with small groups and we extended that to larger groups, which you call yeah. Cultures.
Yes.
And your point is that we start with the dyadic relationship, mm-hmm. Like child-mother, for example, mm-hmm. or partners.
Yes.
And we extend that to a smaller group, but then the group is much, much larger.
Yeah. Yeah.
What is required then?
Okay, so the group cohesion in large groups where you don't even know all the individuals involved is still based on a kind of we're all in this together. And many people have emphasized that it actually requires group conflict. It requires an us versus them mm-hmm. idea. So we are in a collaborative enterprise of mm-hmm. keeping ourselves alive, and one of our major goals is not to let the barbarians come wipe us out. And so group defense is one of the things that brings individuals together into a cultural group. But what of even more relevance, I think, in today's world, it is that I'm in a group with a lot of people that are in my group, but that I don't know them personally. So I don't have a personal relationship to them. But I know they're in my group because they look like me, they dress like me, they talk like me.
Because of laws which are abstract.
Yes, but in the ancestral condition, tens of thousands of years ago, you had to have this similarity, basically mm-hmm. similarity, and part of your group identity was to dress like everyone in the group and to make sure everyone knew you were a member of the group, mm-hmm. to display mm-hmm. your group membership, mm-hmm. And nonconformity is viewed, even today, nonconformity is, okay, now today's world is quite complicated because we're not divided into simple groups. Every group is multiple, you know.
And nonconformity is part of the pluralistic game.
Nonconformity, okay, but in the ancestral condition, as it were, nonconformity is viewed with suspicion. Do you not want to be like us? Do you mm-hmm. not like our ways of doing things? Why are you not conforming? Even today, if I showed up for this interview in a red flowing dress or something, your first thing is, why?
Yeah, it would be fancy, but right. yeah, what?
I come dressed in a normal way, you don't think about my dress. But if I dress in a very strange way, you want to know why. And so mm-hmm. whenever there's nonconformity, it needs an explanation. Certainly in an ancestral condition, part of the question would be, do you not believe in our way of doing things? Mm-hmm. Do you not believe this is a good way to dress? This is the way our ancestors dressed. This is important to us that we dress like this. Do you not believe that? Do you not share our beliefs? Do you not share our values? And so conformity is part of being a member of a culture, and it gains sharpness when it's contrasted with the way barbarians do things, mm-hmm. which is the outgroup. Today's world is so complex. It starts with agriculture. So the ancestral condition is hunter-gatherer groups who travel around.
Small groups.
They travel around, and they mostly ignore other groups. But then when you get to have cultures, there starts to be this conflict with other groups, and there's an in-group, out-group thing. Especially when you get to agriculture, where you have to, this territory is ours, and so we stake out the territory. And then you get cities where people start coming to the food, and you get
right to drink.
Multicultural and all of that. And you know, the question is whether our adaptations for small group cooperation can scale up to this larger situation.
Without
killing us. Well, as I think I end the book by saying, it's worked so far. We're still here. But it obviously has some maladaptive qualities. So ruining the resources of the planet is a good example. That it may be that this sort of in-group, out-group mentality won't be sufficient to meet those challenges. It might if the whole world recognizes those challenges as a task that needs to be addressed by the whole world. That will bring us together to some degree. But if not, then it may be too late.
Is your argument that it works from small groups to extended larger groups because of a sort of self-reproduction of rules or of the concept of the game we play? Because these rules are part of us, and we enforce these rules against ourselves at times.
Yes. Well said. Yes, exactly. I don't know if I...
So how do you get to rules?
Okay, so I think the original... I would use the term norm, meaning roughly the same thing as rules, social norm.
Yeah.
And I would say the original norms are these criteria or standards for the roles in a collaborative activity. So we are going hunting together, hunting antelope
together.
That's
the rule for the norm for hunting.
And you do X and I do Y. Mm-hmm. And if you don't do your part, we're going to fail. If I don't do my part, we're going to fail. We're interdependent. And so when you don't do your part, let's start with a joint commitment. We jointly commit. Let's go hunt an antelope. We go together. Now I'm working hard at it, and I see you sitting by a rock smoking a cigarette, and the antelope's escaping. Then I say, what are you doing? Hmm. Right. Now, you have essentially two choices. You can say, "Bah." Now you're in bad shape because I'm never going to choose you for a partner again.
Right, and probably no one else does.
And probably no one else. So number one, you cheated in the collaboration. And number two, you didn't even care enough to respond to my critique. Mm-hmm. Your other alternative is to say, oh, I'm sorry. You're right. Now you have admitted that you have kept the rules in place, and you have blamed yourself for breaking the rules. You have said, I was wrong, and I know the rules are right. The rules are legitimate. They apply to me. Your critique of me is legitimate. Mm-hmm. I'm deferring to the rules. I had a momentary lapse, but I'm back in the fold now. I'm back cooperative again, and I'll be following
the
rules in the future.
How does argument or argumentation sneak into the game?
Because I can give an excuse. You can say, well, I twisted my ankle, and therefore I'm sitting down, or whatever. And I say, okay, that's a legitimate excuse.
Which presupposes that I have to give you an excuse.
You have to give me an
before.
Excuse. You can't just blow me off like this.
Right.
And if you give me a good excuse, I quit the hunt because I heard a child drowning, then we both agree you should have quit the hunt to go save the drowning child. If you say, Well, I was, you know, I was getting a little tired. And
so that has to do with reward in a certain way.
I don't think I follow that.
Well, if I don't give you an excuse or if I don't accept your argument, you won't cooperate with me anymore, which means my behavior will not be rewarded.
That's true, and that's part of it. However, this is what I try to stress, is it's more than that. Mm-hmm. And what tells you it's more than that is that I believe your critique is legitimate. I agree with you. I agree with you that I was wrong.
So that's making rules sort of work against my laziness or against myself.
Yes. And so what I'm saying is that my laziness, I don't want that to be identified with the real me. Mm-hmm. I had a lapse. That's not the real me.
I'm a better me.
I'm the one who agreed to do it together and who agreed mm-hmm. to play by the rules. And I still affirm that. I just had a momentary lapse a minute ago. Let's forget mm-hmm. that. Let's wipe that part out. Don't make that part of me. And I want to view myself that way too.
So the image of a better we or a better me is very important.
Yes. So I say I'm trying to maintain our partnership. The partnership mm-hmm. itself is important to me. Mm-hmm. That's a value. The we, that the we can continue. Mm-hmm. And flourish is important to me, and all of those kind of preferences things in an evolutionary sense you can end up interpreting them as rewards, and that's why I keep emphasizing this notion of my cognitive recognition of our mm-hmm. equality, because that's not a preference. That's a it's I would say an accurate recognition of the situation, which is that there are multiple individuals, mm-hmm. all of whom are have equal status in the world.
So the cognitive aspect is very crucial for altruistic behavior.
The cognitive aspect is crucial for what I would call a genuine morality, mm-hmm. rather than a strategic morality. Mm-hmm. If the strategic morality is that ultimately I'm going to benefit from being nice, that's fine. But a moral philosopher would tell you that's not really being moral. You have to be moral for the right reason. And the right reason is he deserves to be treated mm-hmm. well. He deserves his fair share. And I think we all have that feeling that... So my favorite recent experiment that we have is where two children come into the room and there's an apparatus and they both pull on the apparatus together, and we have it rigged so that there are four toys and whoop, three of them roll over to one and the other guy only gets one. So they've worked equally, mm-hmm. but they were rewarded differently. Mm-hmm. 80% of the time, the one who got more hands over one to equalize, so they each have two. Now, always important in experiments is the control condition. If they just walk into the room and they same apparatus, and there's already three on my side and one on your side, 11% of the time they share. Mm, four times more if they've generated it together.
Okay.
So there's something about collaborating mm-hmm. that makes me willing to give up something that I wouldn't normally give up. I'm a three-year-old now. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't normally give it up. But I do. So I think that suggests a kind of a sense of obligation, the sense of I override my own selfish desire. That's typically a feeling of, well, I really ought to. He deserves it. So I think they genuinely feel, and certainly if you ask them, they will tell you that something in that along those lines that, well, he should have his too. So they use words like should and must and that kind of thing. So I think that... shows you the power of this sense of obligation that goes with this cognitive insight that we're all equally deserving, and this is the way to make the world right. This is the way to make things the way they should be.
That sounds very almost systematic or logic, that in the end something like morality has to evolve. In the end of your book, you're saying it's a wonder that it did evolve that way.
Well, it depends on your perspective. It's a wonder that it did evolve that way if you take the big view of it. But I guess part of the whole logic of the evolutionary explanation is that given the given this kind of social organization, given these kinds of social conditions and group competition, then this had to happen for us to survive. So in that sense, you can say, instead of a wonder, you'd say, well, it had to evolve to make these, to make everything work. So from that perspective, okay, I can think of it that way.
Thank you for the interview.
You're very welcome. Okay. Good.
Great fun.
Great fun.